طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Welcome to the March 23rd edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On today's show, we feature an interview with Palestinian performance artist and activist Rafif Ziada, by Frank Barat on a radio show, Even the Walls Have Ears, originally broadcast on November 10, 2013. With recent events barring free speech and any substantive talk about Palestine on campus at Northeastern University, it is important to listen to clear, impassioned, and eloquent voices like Rafif. Despite the suspensions and efforts to silence the truth, Palestine will be free. And here is Rafif.
Le mur a des oreilles, conversation pour la Palestine. Une émission proposée par le collectif WOW.
L'émission est diffusée en version originale anglaise. Vous pouvez télécharger une version texte traduite en français sur www.lemuradesoreilles.org.
Welcome everybody, you're listening to Le Mur a des Oreilles, or in English, The Wall Has Ears. Today we are in London and our guest is Rafif Ziada. She's a Palestinian poet and activist. And we are very happy to have her on the show. Good morning, Rafif.
Good morning.
Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Florent. Good morning, Rafif.
Rafif, so I introduced you as a Palestinian poet and activist, but you're much more than that.
I am a refugee from occupied Palestine. My family are refugees to Lebanon. I grew up most of my life in exile, going between countries, and have finally landed in London. I do spoken word poetry. I'm also an activist. I work at an organization called War on Want in London. And I'm also a member of the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions National Committee. And using all of these hats, I tend to organize various things like Israeli Apartheid Week, and I work within the Boycotts, Divestments and Sanctions movement.
We got used to start this program asking our guests why do they engage in Palestinian struggle? You being a Palestinian, the answer seems quite obvious, so I'm not going to ask you that question. But yesterday at SOAS, a university in London, you said that you came to ask yourself, not why am I struggling for Palestinian struggle, obviously, but why are we struggling for, when we are struggling for Palestinian justice? Or did you find the answer?
Just to go back to your first question, I actually think it is useful to ask Palestinians, because we do have a lot of Palestinians that are not active in the struggle for justice for Palestine. And I hear a lot of parents especially tell their kids, don't get involved right now, watch out for your life, don't do any Palestine activism. And I think it's very important that Palestinian, especially youth, get seriously involved in the struggle for Palestine beyond slogans, because it's not enough to have a tattoo of Hamdallah on your arm to say you're a Palestine activist. We really seriously need people to engage and take action and campaign with us on the ground. Having said that, as I was mentioning last night at the event, with the Oslo peace process, I come from a refugee family. We lost most members of our family in Lebanon in the 1982 invasion and the subsequent wars that happened in the camps. My grandfather refused to leave the refugee camp because he thought when the buses come to take us back to Palestine, he wanted to be there or else they would forget him. And it was only 2 months later, after he'd had this conversation, that the camps were invaded and the majority of our family were murdered. And I think it's that sense of what justice for us is that I get from my family about our right to return to our homeland that was lost in Oslo. And I don't think it takes big academic papers and theories to speak about justice in Palestine. I mean, my grandfather was a simple construction worker, and he knew that he had a home in Haifa that he wanted to get back to. With the Oslo process, the Palestinian struggle transformed from a struggle about justice and the right of return to a struggle about statehood, limited statehood, not even full sovereignty, on small sections of Palestine. And now we see that they're completely surrounded by walls and checkpoints, and we have a Bantustan solution on our hands. And that's what Oslo did. So it got me to question, when we say peace and when we say we want to struggle for Palestine, what kind of struggle do we want? What kind of society do we want to live in? And I want to struggle for a free Palestine and not for slivers of land that are fully controlled by Israel.
Refugees, I think people like from outside, you know, that are not involved in sort of pro-justice activism or pro-Palestinian activism, don't realize that the core issue, I think, before Jerusalem being split into two states, and before the borders, refugees is the number one issue. And you, as a refugee yourself, I've got problems to actually go back, right, to Palestine, and you were talking about the fact that you were born in Nazareth, but that you don't have actually a birth certificate that says that you were born in Nazareth. Mm. Why can't you get a birth certificate?
I mean, I think it's interesting when people speak about Palestinians that they've adopted the Israeli categories of you're either 67 or 48 or refugee. But when it comes to the way the Nakba happened, these borders were never solid, these lines. So you can be half 67, half 48, and I'm one of those cases where half of my family is Palestinians with Israeli citizenship and the other half are refugees to Lebanon, which is quite, it's not unheard of and it's not uncommon. Which means because my father wanted his family to see me, I was born there, and then I was refused a birth certificate because that might mean that one day I might claim citizenship. So to this day, I haven't been able to get documentation of where I was born.
Okay, and sticking again with the question on about refugees, it's very... I mean, for people, again, from the outside, they don't... I was listening to Susan Akram yesterday, you know, professor at Boston University, who was saying that the Palestinians are the largest refugee population in the world. I think it's 7 million or something. And this concept of the right of return, which is enshrined in international law, which is a right. This is not something that, you know, a special offer for the Palestinian people. Talking about the right of return, but most of the time we hear the Israeli narrative, which is, you know, well, you expect 6 million Palestinians to come back to our land, the Jewish state, and you know, rip us all to pieces or something. But I think what Zokrot is trying to do is visualizing Palestine and others is to put this into, you know, to change the question from a theoretical question to a practical question. What would happen if the refugees were coming back? What form would it take? For you, like, and your family in Greece, the concept of return, does it still exist? Would you still be able, like, to go back to Palestine if you could, your family as well? And how do they see it? Like, most villages were destroyed. How could it happen in practice?
I mean, I think the practicality of it is quite simple, and there's been many scholars who've done studies on areas that people can go back to. Villages that were destroyed can be rebuilt, and in a lot of the areas where the villages were destroyed, we don't have new construction. A lot of the houses within the major cities, like Haifa, for example, were repopulated with other Arab citizens, with other Palestinians within the state. So the practicality of it, to me, is extremely resolvable. The issue of why it can't happen and the arguments of people who are against it, once it comes down to it and you question them, are simply racist arguments. I have had debates with Zionists where I look them in the eye and I say, what would be wrong with me living in Palestine? And all they can say is, you'll come to destroy us, you'll come to destroy everything. That's based on this racism, extreme anti-Arab racism, that all Palestinians want to do is go back and destroy. And simply, we just want to go back to our homes. It's everyone's right who's ever been kicked out of their land. It's enshrined international law. But if we ever realistically want to resolve what happened there in the region, which started with the Nakba and the ethnic cleansing, and so many villages and people and homes being destroyed, there has to be a reckoning with the fact that the state of Israel was created on the rubble of another people. And unless the state of Israel deals with that, we cannot just move forward. The way they've chosen to move forward is with this Bantustan solution, is with an apartheid solution, where you try to ethnically cleanse as many Palestinians as you can, and control the rest in these Bantustans that you have full control over, as well as, of course, the racism against Palestinian citizens of Israel. That is what we have on offer from the Israeli state. And I think the counter-offer, the more imaginative offer, the more universalistic and human values offer, is to say, why can't we have a region where people live in freedom, in justice, and in equality without racial exclusivities? I mean, I don't want a Christian state, I don't want an Islamic state, I don't want a Buddhist state. I think universally, I don't even like borders. Why can't we just say we want everyone in the region to live in equality? But that does not mean, and some people that put this forward, put it forward as if this means that the Palestinians and the Israelis are equal. That's not what I'm saying. There's a historical wrong that was done to the Palestinian people. Without that being rectified, there cannot be justice or peace in our area. And that means for Zionists who wish to remain in Palestine, they need to become anti-Zionist. We need to go through a decolonization process where they're rehabilitated to be able to live as equals in a state.
And that's the thing, but that's one of the hardest things that's going to have to happen, because you have to, and I know it's hard to say this, but sometimes you have to feel sorry for them, some of the Israelis. And, you know, I've spoken to, Nurit Peled and the Elahan family, anti-occupation, anti-Zionist, for a long, long time. Her youngest son, when he was 16, and when you start thinking of, you know, going to the IDF, etc., wanted to go to the IDF and wanted to do the army. And Nurit couldn't understand. You've been raised, as you know, you had Palestinian in your home, you know, all the time. But it was pretty impossible for him, even if his family had been anti-Zionist all the way, to not to do the army. And Nurit also wrote a book about, you know, the way Palestinians are portrayed in Israeli school books. And when you've been brainwashed to this level, how do you get out of it? You know, there's only a few Israelis, really. It's like, you know, the real left or the real anti-Zionist movement is, what, maybe 0.5%. It's a really tough prospect. I know we don't have, you know, we feel sorry for the Palestinians first, but how to de-brainwash them?
It's interesting you say how difficult it is for them. I remember once in Lebanon, like, as the bombs were dropping, people are always having conversations.
You're talking about when in Lebanon?
I forget Israel bombed too many times. Yeah. I'm talking like 82 period, okay. Yeah. And all the discussions that flowed from that. And a lot of people are always envying the military power. When you have no power whatsoever in terms of military equipment and you see this mighty army, of course you become envious of what they're able to do. And someone asks, well, would you want to be on that side? Would you, if you had the choice, would you not be Palestinian? And I would never take that choice. Because I think the state of Israel right now, what it does is, you have, in order to live with so much racism, it's soul destroying. You cannot produce a society that's oppressing another society kilometers away and produce that entire society where the children have to go and serve at checkpoints and humiliate another people on such a consistent basis and not for it not to be soul destroying. And this is where I think, in terms of how do we change it, this is where I see some of the strength of the boycotts, divestments, and sanctions movement, because the change is not coming from within Israel. And Palestinians have tried everything on the ground, and I think the resistance needs to come from Palestinians, but I think the BDS movement is a good wake-up call to Israelis that you cannot keep behaving in the way that you do. And it is starting to have an effect. And I don't think without that kind of external pressure, there could be a re-evaluation of what Zionism has done. I don't think it will be easy. I don't think it will be simple. But sometimes you do need that type of outside pressure to wake up from such deep racism, which I do think is highly ingrained within the Israeli society today, in every aspect of it. And I find it really strange that we're often told, why are Palestinians teaching their children to hate, when you actually look at what Israeli children are being taught and you look at the textbooks. And when the war in Lebanon, this is the one in 2006, was happening, you saw Israeli children signing missiles that were going to be dropped. To have that level of racism at such a young age is really intense. And that's why I think outside pressure is really necessary to do. The word intifada means a shaking off. And I think you do need a serious shaking off of the racism in that society.
You mentioned resistance just now. People say the Palestinian people need their Gandhi. They need to adopt non-violent means. No one asked this in South Africa. Mandela was the head of spear of the nation, which was an armed struggle. You know, people in Papua New Guinea fighting against Indonesian rules were armed and people were supporting them. When it comes to Palestine, no. The only resistance you can do is non-violent. And actually, it's something, even in the solidarity movement, like, remember when we were in Cape Town and when Leila Khaled shared a panel and she mentioned armed resistance. All right, I didn't agree with everything she said, but you cannot not mention armed resistance. You know, again, in international law, you're an occupied people, you have the choice if you want to bear arms and you know, make your occupier go. But right now, it seems that we have been imposed by the West, etc., that Palestinians can only be peaceful, and therefore, other types of resistance are hardly talked about.
I think when a people resist, what we need to be looking at is the best tools we have at the specific time and how to use them at that time. Is armed resistance what's going to free us today? Is it going to work in conjunction with other things? Is talking about boycotts, divestments, and sanctions in conjunction with other things the way we need to go? It's like having a toolbox, and you need to think at each juncture what is the best mode and what is the best method to be using. There has been today, I think, a co-optation of this idea of nonviolence. And you'll see it, this concept of peaceful resistance, which we had never heard of before in Palestine. It's a very modern Oslo-type lexicon that has entered, peaceful resistance, which it was always called popular resistance. And it is being co-opted to a large extent, I think, by the Palestinian Authority as a method of not doing anything more. So they're like, oh, if you're in the village, go out and have these demonstrations that will be very much controlled by us, that we will know what's happening around them, as a mode to co-opt this. And that trend is really, really worrying. At the same time, I don't think we should paint with a wide brush everyone that says I'm using nonviolent resistance. I think we have a toolbox and we need to be strategic about what we use when.
So can you tell us a bit about the actions Wawon Won't is putting up and using?
Sure. One of the campaigns I'm involved in is around the corporation G4S. G4S is the world's largest private military and security corporation, and they actually have, they're the biggest employer in Africa today. So they are a major corporation that you're starting to see all around the world.
And where are they based?
Everywhere. They're a British corporation. British, okay. They're a British-Danish corporation, which is one of the good reasons they're a target for us here in London, but they're based internationally. In 2007, G4S signed a contract with Israeli prison authorities to give them equipment for the prisons and services for the prisons. They also are involved in giving equipment to settlements and some of the checkpoints as well. So it's one of the corporations we are targeting to end its complicity in the occupation and its support for the occupation. Now, G4S has said they are going to leave the West Bank within 2015. Of course, there's nothing to hold them to that, and they only said that because of major campaigning pressure. However, so far they've refused to speak about their involvement in Israel's prisons. And they take the prisoners, as most people know, the Palestinian prisoners, they take them from the West Bank, and most of the time they're imprisoned within Israel, which is against the Geneva Conventions. So we've had a campaign around G4S. A huge component of it is just educational around what G4S does around the world. But just in June, they had their general annual meeting. We had shares in the company. We went inside. We disrupted the meeting. We asked questions. And the next day, all of the media was around G4S and Palestinian prisons. And this is a campaign that will continue until we pressure G4S to leave the occupied territories and leave its Israel prison contract, because it's completely unacceptable. The other major campaign is Stop Arming Israel. The campaign was initiated around the first war with Gaza in 2008 because there was British military equipment that was being exported to Israel, and arms licenses that were ending up in the F-16s that were doing the bombing. So there was a campaign to end the military trade. We won at that time by revoking 5 licenses, because War on Want and others were able to show that these arms were being used for human rights violations. However, this arms trade continues, and the UK has a lot of arms licenses to this day with Israel. But it's also that arms go the other way as well. So not only are there exports, but there are also imports. And for us, this is a very important point, because the occupied territories have become the playground and the testing ground of Israel for its military equipment. Basically, they use Palestinians as their guinea pigs for all of the equipment that they're selling. So the repression we see in Palestine, the meticulous system of control and surveillance of people's lives, is being exported to the rest of the world. So we see Switzerland, for example, wants to use Israeli drones in order to surveil the borders. The same is happening across Europe, especially for surveillance purposes. The main company involved in this is called Elbit. Elbit gives equipment to the apartheid wall. So you see how this, then Elbit becomes a contractor and a consultant for the wall that's being built on the U.S.-Mexico border, and discussions about a wall being built around the borders of Europe with Turkey. So we see that this conception of the world, this racialized conception of borders and walls and constant surveillance, is being exported. So one of the campaigns is around Stop Arming Israel, and it's one of our consistent ones that I'm really happy to be working on.
Okay, so sorry, and the people can go on the website of War on Want,
yeah,
I think.
The waronwant.org, and all the information is there.
In terms of factions, people use the word radical, for me, in a bad way. When you say, you know, he's a radical, you think like a punk with a, you know, mohawk and, like, you know, not washing himself. You know, radical means taking a problem at its core, so it's actually a very good word. You're talking about Operation Cast Lead and the involvement of British companies. During Operation Cast Lead, there was a Smash Edo ITT campaign where activists from Brighton went to the buildings of Edo ITT and destroyed, actually completely, the office, made it impossible to function for about a week, because Edo ITT was providing small pieces of equipment used in whatever, F-16s, etc. So in terms of those actions, and those clearly direct action that imply also that people are ready to go to jail, are ready to go to court, do you think this is something, because, you know, yesterday we also talked about lobbying, and people keep talking about lobbying, you know, who makes decision? Politicians. So lobbying is crucial. And you responded very well, saying that, you know, we need to, you know, lobbying needs to be part of the struggle. I agree. For me, lobbying is pretty much the latest thing we need to do, because I did some lobbying, and, you know, politicians, they will say, yes, oh, I didn't know about that, oh, I'll raise it to with Mr. Cameron, etc. But as long as, you know, there's not a huge popular struggle and huge popular pressure on them, they're not going to do anything. And I do think that there's direct actions that actually, when they, you know, they've gone to court, most of them, Smash Edo and the Raytheon Five in Ireland, have won. Is also clearly a way for campaigning and for actions to go. We can't, you know, signing petitions and talking to your MP or MEPs is clearly not enough.
I think it's a question of, again, toolbox, what works at what point, but also thinking of building the movement outwards, because by the time you get to taking direct action, you know the politics really well and you're willing to risk getting arrested for it, which is important. But we cannot forever rely on groups of small people to take direct actions. I think they have been strong and they've been very important, and I can't imagine a solidarity movement that doesn't have them. It just wouldn't work. The problem is also meeting and communicating and talking to people who may not know much about Palestine and involving them in the struggle as well, and getting them to the point where we can do mass actions, mass direct actions. And I think that's where the movement is at right now, where we need to grow in a way that everyone says you cannot have normal relations with the state of Israel, you cannot provide equipment to the Israeli prisons, and you will risk mass direct action if you continue to act in this way. And for me, the trick is, how do we keep informing people, getting them involved, making them become the type of activists that are willing to take the risks and to push the envelope and to put things forward. So yeah, I think of it more on those terms, and I'm all for the multi-toolbox. And on the concept of lobbying, I think it is a problem because the left is weak generally. Our conception of being able to affect change through mass change is really weakened, and people think you just go speak to your politician. But even on South Africa, on apartheid, politicians didn't move until there was mass pressure. So I'm interested in building that mass pressure, which doesn't mean simplistically that you don't do lobbying. It just means we need to build that mass pressure. And if there are trigger points where we can use lobbying now, let's use them.
So Rafif, you are a writer and a poet. You're doing spoken word performances. You got a CD out in 2009-10 called Hadil. Can you tell us a bit about the tool of, like, cultural tool to promote Palestinian struggle? Or?
I think the Zionist project has always been about the destruction of Palestinian culture and saying that Palestinians don't exist. That's the bottom line, has always been Palestinians don't exist. So by showing our culture, the cultural resistance, I think it's one of the main ways to speak to power and speak against Zionism, by asserting our existence. I started writing at a very young age, most of it because we were always having to escape and run around from various countries. Writing becomes the easiest way to be inside your head and communicate on paper. I didn't perform until I went to Canada. English is not my first language by any stretch of the imagination. I used to make a lot of mistakes that you shouldn't make if you're Palestinian, like tourist and terrorist. I couldn't pronounce the difference between them. Crab and crap, I didn't know the difference. So I was always shy about performing in English until one day we were organizing a direct action in my university, and I was kicked by a Zionist, and he said, "You deserve to be raped before you have terrorist children." And I was so angry in that moment. That was the first time I got on stage, and I performed Shades of Anger, which has sort of become my anthem. And I've been performing ever since. And I think it's very useful in how it changes people's perspective around Palestine. I mean, most of the time in the mainstream, if you hear about Palestine, you hear the word terrorist associated with it. You're lucky if you hear three Arabic words. So I like the fact that people start to see something different, and I think culture touches people in a different way. If you look at any social justice movement historically, what we remember are the songs, the plays, the poems. I've never heard anyone, except maybe with the Martin Luther King speech, say, "I was involved in that struggle because, you know, that speaker gave such good statistics on that so-and-so subject." I mean, I think it's important to have the statistics and the facts, but as human beings, to endure in a struggle that's long, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, we need our soul to be satisfied as well. And I think culture is a form of resistance in that way that keeps people going in the struggle.
you have to be careful because, you know, Israel tends to assassinate cultural icons like Hassan Kanafani and the rest, so watch out. I just want to say something, like a personal thing. You know, we teach lives and shades of anger. Like, you know, it's gone pretty viral on YouTube. We've got like, what, 300,000 views or something for We Teach Lives. And it blew people away, you know. It's such a powerful... I've listened to it, like, and watched it, honestly, you know, countless of times. And it has the same effect all the time. I feel empowered. I feel... there's so much, you know, you can take out of this poem or spoken word performance. And yeah, this is something very useful, I think, because again, people that are not interested in Palestine or in politics because they think politics is a very abstract concept, when you show them this clip, yeah, it opens the window of Palestine because it's very political. You mentioned Gaza, you mentioned the bombings, you mentioned journalists and the way the media works, and it really brings them, you know, it's again, it's another tool and another door to touch people that otherwise wouldn't have been touched. And I think the cultural scene is booming. There's loads of artists, like the well-known like yourself and Dam and Shadia Mansour and Remy Kanazi. But there's a dark team in Gaza, rappers, and just loads and loads and loads of them. They go, you know, they go beyond the barriers of culture. They go beyond conservatism. And this is something incredibly positive. And that's a side, again, of Palestine, as you're saying, that we don't hear about. You know, the beauty of Palestine, the sense of humor of Palestine, the intelligence, the creativity, yeah. And this is key, and this is great to... when I was in Canada and in the US, in Canada, like in your chiefdom or fiefdom, how do you say that?
Backyard.
Yeah, backyard. Like, you know, we had like... it was during Israeli apartheid. We can actually... let's talk about Israeli Apartheid Week now. You're one of the founders of Israeli Apartheid Week. Can you tell us how it evolved from, was it 2009, the first one, or...?
Oh, much earlier, 2005 now.
Okay,
yeah. How did it evolve? Oh, man, you're making me feel old.
Yeah, you're only 42 or something, right?
Thanks, Frank.
So how Israeli Apartheid Week, how did it start? Why and what changes have you seen since the beginning?
Israeli Apartheid Week actually came out a year before the BDS call came from Palestine. So already a few of us in exile, mainly Palestinian refugees who were in Toronto studying at that time, were starting to discuss, okay, the Intifada erupted, Oslo has failed, Israel wants the Bantustan solution, how do we analyze what's happening? And the word apartheid kept coming up again and again and again. And we wanted to popularize this conception. And a lot of people thought we were mad. People wanted us to speak about the occupation only, 67, and that's it. Don't mention refugees. Don't go beyond the standards. But, you know, with being young, you get a bit daring. And I think a lot of it was just youthful daringness at the time with the group that was there. And we launched Israeli Apartheid Week, and immediately it was attacked by the Zionist lobby. Immediately they wanted it shut down. And the best thing you can do to galvanize youth is tell them that they shouldn't do something or that they're not allowed to do something. And then slowly the week started growing. We never, ever would have imagined that it would grow to the size it is today. But I think the following year, after the launch of Apartheid Week, the call from Palestine was launched, boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. And that was the perfect impetus and catalyst to move forward with apartheid analysis and say, here's the analysis, and this is what you can do. Up to that stage, we were reacting to massacres in Palestine, and we would give people the information, but not be able to say, you are complicit and you have to take action. The BDS call gave us that ability to be able to put the two together. And since then, last year, Apartheid Week happened in 216 countries, and it keeps growing as the movement grows.
And again, this is key, I think, for people that are not aware or into the Palestine or pro-Palestine or pro-justice scene, to you know, to understand that this is a victory or victories in itself. People, even people involved in Palestine struggles, tend to say, look, you've been struggling for 10, 15, 20, 40 years, and on the ground, nothing changes. But things are changing. Slowly, but, you know, it takes time. You know, the struggle is never over. I mean, apartheid South Africa didn't fall in 5 years. And And it's so often, I think that's a word we live in. You know, we live in a world of sound bites, and you know, that's one of your a word you use in your poem. And we live in a world of, like, everything has to be fast, everything has to happen now. And people, like, can be involved for a year in activism and say, look, you know, nothing has changed. But people often forget to look at those small victories that, you know, added together, will eventually lead to something much, much bigger. And that's why when, like, you know, the Finkelstein interview saying that BDS is a cult and there's, like, maybe I can count the victories on, like, one hand and not even, you know, this is so wrong. Because, he used the narrative of, like, mainstream media of, like, you know, we need this to happen now, we need to see changes now. But changes are happening. And the fact that you have 210 plus cities doing Israeli apartheid week is immense. And I think as a movement, we have to also try to mainstream this, that this is happening, change is happening. But that, I mean, John Berger, the English author, in his book, that I don't know if you've read it, it's called From A to X. I love it. And it's... I think one of the, I think it's Javier, the guy in the book, or Xavier, says to his partner Aida, the struggle would be endless. And for me, this is a key concept, because, you know, a struggle means everything. You know? It's about also struggling to be a better person. It's never going to stop. And people that are, you know, you can't, being a pro-Palestine or pro-justice activist is not like a job, you know. It's not like you're signing up for 3 years, it's part-time or it's full-time and you get, like, benefits. And it's something that will go on for a long time. And if, as a movement, we manage to explain people and to explain to people that this is life, actually, itself, you know, and struggling is a lot better than dying on your knees, you know, we will have succeeded somehow, even if Palestine is not free in 10 years.
And I think even if Palestine is free, it's not like we'll go back and things will be fine. In the past year, I've been doing a lot of traveling because I finally can, after finally getting documents, after having lived undocumented most of my life. I've been traveling to other parts of the world, and it's... I think sometimes as Palestine activists, we tend to be very insular and think that Palestine is the worst exploitation happening in the world. And certainly there is exploitation, and there's the occupation is horrifying, but there's exploitation happening in other places. So definitely our struggle is endless, because we want justice not just for Palestine or not just in Palestine, and we need larger horizons. When we're speaking about justice, I definitely don't think just me being able to go back to Palestine will be the end of the struggle. I'd like to start there, and I think the struggle will actually begin once I'm on the beach in Haifa about what the next move is going to be.
And that's the thing about Palestine. I think Palestine for me is a snapshot, if you want, of what's wrong with the world right now, but it's also an opportunity if we succeed to show what would be possible in a fairer society, in a fairer world. So that's why this is such a symbolic case, because, you know, it hardly can be more wrong than what's happening on the ground in Palestine. But if we manage to open the doors and the borders, you know, it can be a vision of a new society. And yeah.
I mean, I always say I think Israel today is a microcosm of the type of world we don't want. When you look at the apartheid wall, when you look at how Palestinian labor is treated at terminals, completely controlled, exploitation at that level of actually having a gate open for a few hours so workers can go through and back and have no rights while they're in industrial zones, that's similar to the maquiladoras happening on the Mexico-US border. It's similar to these industrial zones around the world. But it's so stark, and because it's in such a small area, coupled with a military occupation, it's a microcosm of the type of world I don't want to live in.
So what are you writing out of, like, anger, hope, rage, hatred?
I think it's certainly anger and hope. And I'm not... You know, I used to think in the Western sense we shouldn't say we're angry. And when I first started speaking in the West, people would say you sound too aggressive and a bit too angry and too passionate. That was the word being used. And And at the end, I decided, yeah, I am angry, and there's a lot to be angry about, and I'm not sure why you're not angry, so I need you to get a bit angrier as well. So I embraced it, and hopefully in a healthy way. And I do have a lot of hope. On a very, very personal level, the stories that I've collected in Hadil especially have all been stories of Palestinian girls, young girls, including myself and members of my family, and the case of the girl whose family was murdered on the beach in Gaza, the case of the girl who died through the bombing, which is where the name Hadil comes from. Because I feel, even in the solidarity movement, that the real impact of Israel's violence against Palestinian women and girls in particular is usually erased, because the violence of Israel isn't just when the bombs are dropping, when people remember about Palestine. It really remains like in your bones and in your skin. And in my own family, the ramifications of Israeli violence have lasted, and, you know, with mental health issues, with survival issues. So the violence recurs and continues, and I think that very human level of the stories of Palestinian girls doesn't come through. So on that level, whenever I see these scenes on TV, it's like my story over and over and over. And it's like the Palestinian people have been under siege since the creation of the State of Israel. And I would say that's where it comes from, on the most basic personal level.
And that's what I really like about your pieces, is that you are putting names before numbers. Or we always hear like, oh, 1,000 Palestinians died, and you put names. Hadil is a person, and it could be like my sister, my daughter, and that's important, I think, too.
And that's what you get when you actually go to Palestine. And obviously, I mean, it's important to go. Once you're there, a lot of Palestinians tell you, now you've been here, go back and do the work. But it's such an eye-opening. I'm going to quote someone else now. Arundhati Roy was saying that it's something like once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And I know for me personally, it was also a change. You know, I'd been an activist for a few years before 2007 when I went for the first time. I'd read loads of books, I'd been to events, I'd seen films. But I went there for like 10 days. And when I came back, I couldn't not see it anymore. And I felt more angry, and I felt more confident, because, you know, a lot of Israelis or something in talks will tell you, have you been there? You know, I live in Tel Aviv, there's bombs, have you been there? And if you haven't, it's actually quite tough. You go, no, I haven't, but I've watched 10 documents, you know. Mm-hmm. But once you've been, you come back empowered, and you know the people, and Palestinians feel like family. So it really personalized the struggle, and I think made me a better activist. And everyone that has been there will come back a better person and a better activist.
I had an activist from South Africa who told me, because this theme comes up a lot, that people should go and you should see with your own eyes. And certainly when people go and see, although I do have this problem with like seeing Palestine, because Palestine itself is fragmented across Palestinians everywhere now. So there is the on the ground West Bank, Gaza, and of course the things that are happening within Israel, the treatment of Palestinian citizens, but there are also the refugee camps. And I think the experience of exile cannot be forgotten. But this South African activist was saying, you don't always have to see injustice firsthand with your own eyes to be able to do something about it. And sometimes I worry that unless you can afford to travel to Palestine, then you shouldn't do anything. A lot of people knew and fought against South African apartheid without traveling to South Africa. And I think people should be able to do the same in the case of Palestine. But certainly, if you have the means to go, then please do go.
I'm just saying this because, in a way, for me, it was to say, if you need a wake-up call, and if you're like a passive activist, go at 3 a.m. at checkpoint 300 between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, and see 2,000 Palestinians, mostly male, queuing like cattle, you know. And it'll make you feel sick inside and make you understand that this is... It's like, you know, it felt to me when I was there, it felt like science fiction. It felt like, oh, well, you know, 1984, when I came back to Europe and explained to people what I saw and what I heard, you know, Palestinians being shot in Aida refugee camp playing football by, you know, people just didn't believe me. They just didn't want to believe that. You know, it's, again, cognitive dissonance, but they didn't want to believe that this situation was happening. And if people were knew what was happening, really what was happening, and if the media was doing its job, the situation would be drastically different, yeah, I think.
I think it is hard for people to believe what's happening because it's like science fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, the type of brutality and surveillance mechanisms, and you know, you can't get a driver's license unless the Israelis approve. Everything has to do with Israel's security system. It's total control of people's movement and life, and you have an apartheid wall that people have to go through terminals, and then the World Bank tells us those terminals are amazing for workers, they're going to air condition them. It's like a science, it's the sickest of science fiction, and it's being exported to the rest of the world. And I think it's important that we keep stressing this, the export of it to the rest of the world.
Okay, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to wrap it up. So, Rafif, for the people who want to listen to your pieces, I'm sure they can find some videos on YouTube, but they also can order your CD somewhere.
Yeah, it's on CD Baby, and people can order it online, MP3s or the hard copy, and just Google Rafif Ziada CD Baby, and it's what you get.
That's great, and don't forget to check the War on Want website, which is waronwant.org. You can also check our website, lemuradesoreilles.org, where you'll find this talk in podcast. Frank, thank you very much.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks, Jeanne.
Thank you, Jeanne, for the technical part of this program, and thank you very, very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.